if you celebrated 4th of July this week, you probably did so with some time-honored favorites. Parades, hot dogs, maybe watching fireworks. The holiday has taken on a familiar shape over the years, but Americans haven't always celebrated this way.
Our next guest recently wrote about how the South celebrated Independence Day in the years right after the Civil War in a piece for The Atlantic titled, When the 4th of July Was a Black Holiday.
Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts are professors of history at California State University, Fresno, and co-authors of the new book, Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy. Blaine, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Ethan, great to have you with us as well.
Great to be here.
Now, Blaine, what were 4th of July celebrations like in the South before the Civil War?
Well, before the Civil War, 4th of July celebrations in the South would have looked a lot like 4th of July celebrations in the North, with white Americans, white Southerners, celebrating by taking a day off from their labors, enjoying barbecues, listening to recitations of the Declaration of Independence, and generally kind of reflecting on what the day meant to Americans.
And what did it mean to Americans? What were the main themes of 4th of July before that horrific Civil War?
Well, most communities did recite the Declaration of Independence, and so there was a kind of emphasis on that second paragraph in particular. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the South, these were sentiments that people talked about. As we get closer and closer to the Civil War, however, many white Southerners were more interested in the parts of the Declaration of Independence that emphasized the right to self-government. As they see themselves really starting to fight against a federal government that was opposed to the spread of slavery throughout the United States, they start to draw parallels between their position fighting an overbearing federal government and the position of the colonists who had been fighting a tyrannical British monarchy.
And Ethan, you two open your piece with a quote from Frederick Douglass talking in 1852, so about a decade before the Civil War. He's talking about slavery and the 4th of July specifically. What did the holiday represent for slaves at the time?
Well, for both slaves and for free African Americans, Douglass, by that point, he'd been born a slave, but he had escaped to the North. The holiday was one that they used, particularly free blacks, used to underscore the hypocrisy of the situation in the United States, the hypocrisy of crafting a Declaration of Independence that calls all men created equal, but nonetheless having an institution like slavery where millions of people were enslaved and where hundreds of thousands of more free blacks were treated as second-class citizens. So folks like Douglass, fellow abolitionists in the North, including William Lloyd Garrison, a white abolitionist who very famously burned the Constitution in 1854 on the 4th of July, they often used the holiday as a time to point out this hypocrisy, to point out the gap between the realities of life for African Americans and this soaring sort of rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence. And so that's what Douglass was doing in 1852 when he gives his address. And he gives his address not on July 4th, but on the 5th of July, the day after the 4th of July, which was a day that Northern African Americans, like Douglass, he gives his address in Rochester, New York, they often chose to mark the holiday on the 5th. One reason is sort of for a practical purposes. When whites, North, South, East, and West celebrated the holiday, they often did it the way people do today, and that is they drank lots of alcohol. And it was a way to, by celebrating it on the 5th or marking it on the 5th, African Americans could avoid drunken white revelers who might target them. But also they chose this the day after the 4th to underscore this hypocrisy.
Hmm. But they were celebrating on July 5th, it sounds like. So for the African Americans, what were they celebrating?
I think it's complicated. Certainly for abolitionists like Douglass and Garrison, they were critiquing the nation. They were using it as a moment to critique the nation. But more generally, there were plenty of African Americans, both free and enslaved, who enjoyed a holiday, enjoyed celebrating. In the South, many slave owners gave the enslaved that they owned the 4th of July off, allowed them not to work that day, permitted them not to work that day. And so they would celebrate that moment of freedom, the moment to have a little bit of rest. But also they did look to the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, and they saw those ideals as something they wanted to force the nation to live up to.
And Blaine, that celebration on the 5th eventually shifted, and African Americans started to reclaim the 4th of July. What triggered that change?
Well, of course, the biggest change was that the Confederacy lost the Civil War and the Union, or the United States, won. And this, of course, meant that slaves were free. And so they believed that one of the best ways to mark and celebrate their newfound freedom was to really claim Independence Day as their own. And you see this happening throughout the South as soon as the Civil War is over in the spring of 1865. That first 4th of July, newly emancipated slaves claim that day as their own. And you have big celebrations in many major southern cities with thousands of revelers. A lot of freed slaves came from the countryside. They would leave plantations and go into cities. And once in these cities, they had these gigantic celebrations, and you would have orators on stage reading the Emancipation Proclamation, reading the Declaration of Independence, and really emphasizing that second paragraph that we referenced a minute ago. Also reading the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, the 14th Amendment, which granted citizenship to newly freed slaves, and then ultimately the 15th Amendment, which gave voting rights to black men. So they took this day that had always been a day of freedom and liberty for white Americans and said, now it's our day for freedom and liberty.
I can only imagine all of those ways that you just said that they marked the holiday. Those are all anathema to the Confederate citizens who had just lost this war. Very raw emotions. Ethan, what were white people in the former Confederacy doing while the African Americans were celebrating?
Well, they were sitting out the holiday, for one. They'd celebrated with great gusto up until 1861. In places like Charleston, South Carolina, which is the focus of our book, they abruptly stop in 1861 and don't celebrate it. White Southerners don't celebrate it thereafter. Former Confederates also were angry and tried to stop, in many cases, unsuccessfully for a while, tried to stop black celebrations of the 4th. In Charleston, they tried to put the very first one in July 4th, 1865, just months after the Civil War had come to a close. They tried to force the Union Army that's there in Charleston to shut down the Black 4th, but the Union Army refused to do that. Thereafter, for at least a decade in most places in the South, white Southerners could do little beyond complain in their journals, write nasty, often racist articles about 4th of July celebrations in white newspapers. But because they lacked political power during Reconstruction, they really couldn't put these couldn't stop black 4th of July celebrations.
We're talking with Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts. They're historians and authors of Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy. And we're talking about when African Americans really claimed the 4th of July as their own. And I want to talk more about those celebrations. They were called, is it Tullaloos?
Yes. So in Charleston, the 4th of July celebration became known as Tullaloo. So that is a name that applies specifically only to the celebration there. And the name Tullaloo came from a dance. So the freed men and women in Charleston on the 4th of July often gathered down at the Battery. And if your listeners are familiar with Charleston, this is at the base of the city peninsula. And there's a garden there called White Point Garden. So the freed men and women would gather in White Point Garden and dance the Tullaloo. And the Tullaloo was a ring dance that involved 12 men and 12 women. And a woman would go into the middle of the circle while the group around her sang and clapped. And they would say, go hunt your lover, Tulalu. Go find your lover, Tulalu. And this was a significant moment in these celebrations. There were a couple of things going on. One thing that was happening is that these freedmen and women were kind of subtly mocking the courtship rituals of their former masters. The other thing that was happening, I would argue, is that they were also very much celebrating their own freedom, particularly their newfound freedom to choose and marry their own romantic partners. Mm-hmm. So the Tulalu became very important in Charleston, and we have newspaper accounts that talk about how there might be 50 groups in Charleston at White Point Garden dancing the Tulalu from 8 a.m. in the morning until after midnight on the 4th of July.
So the Tulalu was first danced in 1876, so a decade after this tradition had been going on, but because it was such a popular ring dance, it in the couple years afterwards, it becomes shorthand for the holiday itself, and well into the 1880s and 1890s, they would refer to Black Charlestonians' 4th of July as the Tulalu. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like women were really central to these celebrations. Was it also a way for them to really step out and be leaders in their community?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the striking things about that Tulalu dance that Blaine was just describing is that women play a central role in it. And, you know, this is a period when women, African-American or white, don't have a big public presence. And even in public ceremonies like 4th of July celebrations, there's not that much space made for African-American women to participate. They are not the ones who would gather and give orations and recite the Declaration of Independence, recite the Emancipation Proclamation. They were rarely, on occasion they were, but they were rarely those who were leading the parades that were held on the 4th of July. So the Tulalu, we think, is one of these remarkable moments where women do have a big role.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts. They're professors of history at Cal State Fresno, and we're talking about their research that stems from their new book, Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy. It's about a time when Black Southerners used Independence Day to celebrate the end of slavery.
And we want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Have you heard of this time in American history? What do you think about how Independence Day has changed over time? If you're a person of color or an immigrant, what does the 4th of July mean to you? Call in now and tell us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We're continuing our conversation with historians Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts about their recent piece for The Atlantic, When the 4th of July was a Black Holiday.
And we're looking for your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think about when you celebrate the 4th of July? Does the holiday have special meaning for you? Do you think it's a day where we should come together to celebrate the country, or do you think it's a day to reflect on where we still have work to do? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Blaine, just before we took our short break, we were talking about the Tulalus and what a great celebration it was and how the whole African-American community came out for it and what an institution it was. It's more than a little hard to imagine that these kinds of very open, very joyous celebrations were not met with opposition or maybe even violence from the Confederate whites. How were they reacting when they had these celebrations going on right in their midst?
Well, as Ethan suggested earlier, white former Confederates could not really do all of that much in the earliest years of these celebrations, these Black Fourth of Julys in the South. And that's because of Reconstruction and the fact that the Republican Party, which was the progressive party at that point and the ally of former slaves, was in power throughout much of the South during this period. That does change starting in the kind of early to mid 1870s. And so what starts to happen is that you see former Confederates, white conservatives in the region at this point, members of the Democratic Party, actually starting to use 4th of July celebrations as a way to violently reassert their power and try to regain control of the South. And in South Carolina, the best example of that would be something called the Hamburg Massacre. And this was a conflict in Hamburg, South Carolina, over a black militia parade on July the 4th that year, in which white vigilantes ended up killing 17 African Americans. And so this is an example of how this holiday, white conservatives, white Southerners used it to try to wrest control back from black Southerners.
And that took place in 1876, which is at the tail end of this reassertion of political power by white conservatives known as redemption. And South Carolina was one of the last three Southern states to be redeemed by white conservatives, along with Louisiana and Florida. And in the aftermath of that, this is when white Southerners start to implement Jim Crow laws and customs, start to segregate the South, start to disenfranchise African-American voters, and eventually they also start to quash these black celebrations of the 4th. In Charleston, for instance, city leaders pass ordinances aimed at driving Tullalo out of White Point Garden, that beautiful park that Blaine was discussing a little bit earlier, and eventually out of the city altogether. And by the early 1900s, the Tullalo and Black Fourths across the South have been largely gone.
And Blaine, your book is about who controls how we collectively remember slavery. And this decade-long period of Black Independence Day celebrations seems like a pretty rare moment in history where recently freed slaves, people who had no power politically or culturally, really controlled their own narrative. Did it surprise you that it was possible to have that kind of self-agency so quickly after emancipation?
Yeah, sure. In a sense, it did. This was really a remarkable period in the South when the memory of slavery was controlled by former slaves. In a place like Charleston, in addition to 4th of July parades, they had other celebrations marking the end of slavery. Probably the most famous one would be in March 1865, and it was actually, we call it the Slavery is Dead Parade. They had a parade marking the death of slavery with a hearse carrying a coffin that said "Slavery is Dead" on the side. And it was really important, this moment in South Carolina and Charleston history, and really the history of the South in general, that freed slaves could control the memory and insert themselves into these public spaces in a way that they absolutely could not before the Civil War, and that became increasingly difficult as white Southerners regained control of the South. And you don't really see African Americans pushing their own memories of slavery into the public sphere again until the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 60s.
And what about the white Southerners? I mean, often it doesn't take very long after even very significant events that collective memory starts to either fade or kind of get rewritten. How were white Southerners depicting slavery and the end of slavery even in the couple decades after the Civil War?
That's a great question. I mean, really, what our book traces is the 150-year battle between the memories of white Southerners, in most cases, and the memories of black Southerners. And we call the two traditions of memory that they develop the whitewashed memory and the unvarnished memory of slavery. And so the whitewashed memory is a tradition that's developed by former slaveholders and their descendants, and they start pushing this narrative immediately after the Civil War, but it takes a while for it to really take hold in the public in a place like Charleston. This is a tradition, the whitewash tradition. It downplays the importance of slavery to the history and to the wealth of Charleston, of South Carolina, of the nation. It downplays the importance of slavery to the coming of the Civil War. The lost cause tradition comes out of the whitewashed memory of slavery. It's also a tradition that argues that slavery wasn't that bad a thing, that it was a benign thing, even a beneficial and civilizing thing, something that helped the enslaved as well as people who owned slaves. So that's the whitewashed memory, and former slaves and their descendants and some white allies push against that and argue that no, that slavery was central, it was brutal, it was violent, and it did cause the Civil War, and that's the unvarnished memory. But for the better part of the last 150 years, it's the whitewashed memory that predominated across the South, and especially in a city like Charleston.
Well, and as we start to wrap up, Blaine, you know, we saw major conflicts over Confederate monuments and whether they should be maintained and preserved or whether they should be taken down. And that was just about a year ago. Did that surprise you that this can be such a very emotional issue for so many people on both sides of the issue?
You know, not really. One of the things that we discovered over the course of our research is how fraught and contested many of these monuments were from the very beginning. And a really good example of that would be the John C. Calhoun Monument that is in downtown Charleston. This was a monument that was erected in the late 18th century and that honors a man who once called, late 19th century, that once called slavery a positive good. And so white Charlestonians venerated him and put up this monument to him, but black Charlestonians, of course, had very different feelings. And they protested that monument from the very beginning.
And we'll have to leave it there. Ethan, thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And Blaine, thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you.
Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts are historians and the authors of Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we start a week-long series on different aspects of immigration in America. First, an introduction to U.S. immigration law.
We look at the struggles that women farmers face in caring for their children and their farm.
And we examine how religious faith influences the emotional life of those who believe.
That's Monday on Central Time.